another set of words from Rilke to kick off our questions and maybe even some answers too. He says to us, "Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers, which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer." And with that as our introduction, what's something you miss about Roger and something you enjoy about working with Christina? Something that I really appreciated about coming on board here with the Reverend Roger Birchhausen, who's our former senior minister, is how intentional the process of onboarding was. I felt that he and everyone on staff at the time was very intentional to orient me to the history, the people, the reasons, the challenges, the successes of the congregation. And so I felt very ready to engage relationship with people and to steward the institution and all of the people who have made it what it is. And I feel that I am beginning my shared ministry with Reverend Christina Leon Tracy in the same context. One of the first conversations that I think we even had during her candidating week was about how it is that we wanted to make sure that we were in right relationship with each other and that we really understood our different roles. What does it mean to be the associate minister, to be the senior minister, and how a depth of understanding those roles could create a very, very rich partnership between the two of us. And one of the ways that we've been talking about that with each other is we've been saying to each other that we want to begin as we wish to continue. And that has felt comforting, but it's also felt really exciting because there's a challenge in that. We're going to be working together for a long time. What can we accomplish in serving this congregation together? And one of the ways that we're thinking about that question is we have worked with, and then we will again work with, a consultant. He works with nonprofit leadership types. He runs a consulting firm in Iowa. He came to sit with us and think about some of these questions. Now he's going to let us live into it a little bit, live into the answers, Rilke would say, and then he's going to come back in about a month and check in with us. How's it going? So I'm excited. Other than turning in our pledge cards before the deadline, I like this already. What one thing can we do to make your life easier? So two things. Please do turn your pledge card in before the deadline. And the second thing is that it would make my life easier if you would do what I actually feel that so many of you are doing, which is to value this place and to care about it and to help us in the ways that we need help. This is an institution. It's a human institution, so there are ways that we need to address certain challenges. And then there are also a lot of things to celebrate about this place. And when people do that thoroughly and they're patient with the fellowship's faults and with my faults personally, but when they bring their full lives, that helps. That makes me feel like I'm serving a place that's actually serving the needs of the people, and that's really meaningful for me. And of course, I think then it's meaningful for you as well. With all the hate in the world, I'm afraid to be myself. What do I do? This is a really tender question, and if the person who wrote it would like to talk with me about it one-on-one. If you're open to shooting me an email, you certainly are not required to do so, but I would be very interested in just hearing more about your story and maybe sharing a little bit about mine. I think that the key, and I say the key, it's not a trick, there's not a magic solution, but I think the key is to find people who will not gloss over the fact that there is a lot of hate in the world. We don't need to cling to people or ideas that tell us that the hate and the fear isn't out there, because that's dishonest. And dishonesty doesn't help us survive. But if we can find people who are real about the hate and the fear, but who also live vibrant lives themselves and help us figure out in community how to make a minute-by-minute plan to survive, but also how to be a part of something beautiful that's larger than just one individual, that can make all of the difference. There are many ways that I feel very protected from the hate in the world, but there are ways that I am targeted by it. Some of my identities are I'm Jewish, I'm female, I'm fat, I'm gay. These are all identities that have caused me to be harassed on the street and to have had laws made against me in the country I live. And I feel very scared and sad about that sometimes. But on my in my best moments, when I feel seen and heard and celebrated, and I'm around people who are living their own versions of whoever they are, I wouldn't trade any of those identities for anything in the world. And that is even while I am aware also of the hate and the fear. But we can learn to live with that. We just need each other. What 2 to 3 issues do you feel are most concerning involving the health of the fellowship? What keeps you up at night? Oh, small questions I see I'm getting. I think that one of the issues on our radar collectively is about stewardship and institutional health and growth. I know these aren't sexy buzzwords, but the reality is I think this is a really healthy congregation, and I think that we all have ideas about ways that we could be more and better. I know I have a million ideas, and I bet most of you do too. And I think that what we're going to have to do, and I actually think that Reverend Christina is really, really well poised to help us have this conversation, so there's going to be some help and structure, is we're going to have to think really clearly about, like, what are our priorities and what are the resources that we're willing and able to offer in the service of our priorities. I don't think that anyone wants to feel harangued to give more money. I think a lot of people here give with a generosity that often astounds me. And I think we're going to have to look at what we want to accomplish and what the dollar amount is going to be. The thing about a spiritual community is that we're not trying to make a profit. And we don't come here to talk about how to streamline our organization with fiscal efficiency. And then the other truth is that the work that we do, the programs that we run, having staff, having air conditioning, these things aren't free. And so we're going to have to figure out what the right balance for us is. Do we want to retrench or coast? Do we want to break through some ceilings? Not literally, we just got this up. And how is that going to go? And I actually think that having a really frank, honest conversation where the congregation sets the agenda is the way to go. But I also think that that's going to be hard, because we're going to have to talk about that balance of call versus comfort, and we're going to have to talk about money. But I think we're up to it. And I know there are people here who are hungry for that and are pushing the leadership to do that more and better. What keeps me up at night? Well, I worry sometimes that in the hustle and bustle of congregational life, that certain people feel alone, that there are people who have tried to connect and it hasn't worked, that they approached me in a moment where my attention was elsewhere, and not out of malice, but just out of inattention. I didn't understand that they were asking for connection. Or someone who really wants help but doesn't know, you know, what committee or what staff person to approach. And I know that I'm fallible, and that probably there are people here who wanted some piece of attention, and I just spaced it. I gave the wrong attention, or I failed to look in your direction at all. And it doesn't keep me up at night that I'm not perfect. That's life. But I do have sometimes the burden of knowing that we're a big and growing and vibrant community. And I worry sometimes about the few individuals who might sometimes get lost. So maybe this is a good invitation. If you're nodding your head, maybe just even on the inside, like, yeah, what's up with that? I wanted something and I didn't get it. Shoot me an email. I can't promise to meet all of your needs, but I can always promise that I'll try to listen and to believe you that you have them. What will the fellowship do this year to be leaders in social justice in our community in the Fox Valley? I'm really proud of the commitment that we made last spring to become a place of sanctuary for those facing discrimination as immigrants. And I think that that's not an issue that's getting smaller in this country, the opposite. And I look forward to being challenged by that commitment of ours and figuring out how I and we can lead and can work with others in the area. What are your top priorities in your spiritual journey, in your spiritual journey / practice? In my spiritual practice right now, I'm trying to give myself space to not try to be productive, to not try to be good at anything. I love my identities. I really like being a mom. I really like being a wife. I really like being a minister. I like being a human being. But sometimes I need to just carve space to simply be and to simply think about what feels true in a moment, and to segregate that from the lofty and mundane things that get on my to-do list. What could possibly be even one lesson in suffering? Someone said, wow. So one of the core narratives in Christianity is that suffering is redemptive. So by narrative, I mean one of the ideas that's really important, one of the ideas on which Christian ideas and practices are built, is the idea that suffering redeems you. Through suffering, you can be saved. And I think that some people find a really beautiful way to make meaning in that framework, and I respect that, but that doesn't work for me. I don't think it's intrinsically good to be enslaved, to be raped, to be abused, to be terrified and alone, to have your life bleed away from you in a bottle or a needle. I don't think that suffering is good, and I don't recommend it. I do think that life contains suffering, right? We have to invite in some Buddhist wisdom that any of us who have been alive have suffered and will suffer. And for me, one of the lessons in that is that resisting suffering can be incredibly meaningful. Figuring out how to recognize the symptoms of depression within yourself and ask your loved one to help you look online for some counselors, that can be a tremendous experience of coming to terms with your own resources. I don't think that it's right to be bullied on the playground, but if you figure out that telling a particular teacher means that they'll help you make a strategy to directly address the person or work with the school district to make a policy, you know, et cetera, that one thing that you can learn is that your voice matters and that you have agency. And those, to me, are lessons worth learning? I feel squirmy when the word amen closes the sermon. What does this word mean to you? Do you think it resonates with members who aren't Jewish or Christian? So amen is, its root is Hebrew. Don't ask me any more about the etymology because that's all I remember from seminary. But it comes to us from Hebrew. And because Judaism sort of burst and grew in connection with Christianity and Islam, all of those three Abrahamic religions use the word amen as a way to sort of proclaim that something has been said or done. The reality is that because language is so important anthropologically to groups of people, almost all cultures have some way, some phrase, sometimes a gesture, but some spoken phrase that acknowledges that an intention has been set and that seals it. So for Abrahamic religions, often that the word that seals it is amen. And that's not going to work for everyone. Some UU congregations, there's a lot of amen. Sometimes you'll hear more of kind of neo-pagan inspired sort of set and sealing phrases like blessed be, may it always be so, etc. And I would just say that you have not only a right to decide which words you really like, but you have a sacred obligation to figure out what works for you and what feels good and what helps you dive into the spiritual journey that you're called to take and what words are, you know, maybe they're off-ramps instead of on-ramps. And I would really recommend to you the practice of, if you ever find a word that gets said around here a lot that just is, you know, makes you squirmy, that's a good way to put it, to think about, like, what's a word that you could substitute? Is there a place of translation that you could, is there a word of translation that you could offer yourself so as to not be taken too far off of the beaten path? And if you come up with a good one, let me know. I'm definitely not going to promise to not say anything that doesn't feel right to anyone. But I really try to use a lot of different words at a lot of different times to try to hit some of the range of what feels true to us. And I love encountering new ways to express these really big ideas. What? Aho. You guys are feisty today. I like that. Your take on Charlottesville. Well, I think it's really important to note that what's happening in the public square in Charlottesville is not actually new. I think that we need to remember that this country was founded on white supremacy. And so as much as it's important to evaluate how or if it's escalated recently and what to do and what about it feels current, I think it's really important to acknowledge that it isn't new. And my other comment about that is also about a historical view. I don't know about you, but I really like history, and I have a very frequent experience of learning about historical events or moments and thinking, if I was there, I would have spoken out. I would have stood up. I am someone who would do something. And I think that today, like every day, but today, any of us who've read the news about Charlotte, this is one of those moments. If you wonder who you would have been in history and in Germany in 1939 or in, you know, the antebellum South and, you know, or any of these sort of big or little moments in history, we don't ever really know, but why don't you try to figure out who you can be now, who you can be today? Eli Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor and author, is a complicated thinker, and I don't actually agree with all of his public stances, but he said that for him the lesson of surviving the horrors of the Holocaust was that the awareness that sometimes you have to pick a side. And so when we hear politicians talk about many sides, I remember what Elie Wiesel experienced and what it called him to say, which is that there are sides and you have to pick a side. And so that's a commitment that I'm making to myself when I look in the mirror. And I don't expect that your version of that is going to look exactly the same as mine, but I do recommend to you the practice of looking in the mirror and deciding what side you're on and behaving accordingly and helping me do so as well. Okay, subject change. Getting married soon. Do you have advice for a long, happy marriage? So first, congratulations. Here is my advice that I am, this is, like Rilke said, one of the answers that I am living into, because I've only been with my partner for 8 years, so some of you probably have me, I mean, some of you definitely have me beat. One of the ways that I describe to couples I get to work with the process of creating the vows is I talk about how making a commitment is that your vows will bind you. It's not fine print. It doesn't trap you. It's not a concrete, it's not concrete that encases you, but it is a firm commitment. And so for me, the balance is that the commitment that you make deserves to be honored with depth, so go deep. Figure out what your commitment is and go as deep as you can with it. But don't forget the piece that's about width, that your vows are alive with the spirit of life itself. And so some of the commitments that you make, some of the parts of who you are, some of what you see in your beloved, that will change, that will evolve. If it doesn't, that's a problem. And so to me, it's about paying attention to the balance of depth, but also width, so that you can be together, but that the together is about the journey. So that if one or both of you experiences movement in your life, instead of it being a threat, it's an invitation for growth for everyone. It's exciting and a relief to have a settled minister again. I was thinking the transition is over, but we are maybe in the final phase of transition, settling in with our senior minister. Is there one last UUA transition training module we can use as a guide? Are there pitfalls to watch out for? Mistakes we could make in our assumptions, or good practices to go by? That I recommend to you is one that I'm trying to embrace of simply being open and curious. And I think this is a really wise question because it recognizes a truth. The transition isn't open. We're still in a phase of newness. You haven't learned how to work with Reverend Christina as your minister, and she hasn't learned how to do that with us. And as that falls into place, we will find there'll be moments when we're like, this really, really is familiar. We know what it's like to have a settled senior minister. This feels great. But there's also going to be moments of realizing, things are shifting. I don't know how I feel about that. And so I think the best practice is to be open and to be honest and to apply curiosity to this next phase of transition, even as we're glad that she's settled, and I echo the relief of that. With the very meaningful men's and women's groups here, how do we go forward to have safe, meaningful places for all as we learn more about gender identity? This is something that Marie Luna, our Congregational Life Coordinator, and I have been talking about lately. We really value that small groups are places where people who share a gender identity can go deep in certain ways. Not all of our small groups are gendered, but some of them are. And that's really a strength. But we also are aware that we want to think about a better way to label that, so that when someone sees that there's like a women's group, that we're explicit about the fact that that means that those who self-identify as women are welcome. And so that those, sort of the how we label things are ways to remind ourselves to have expansive definitions about gender identity, and to also communicate to people who might be curious but afraid to ask what that means, because we've actually had a lot of gender diversity within most, if not all, of our groups. And I think it actually really makes sense to offer people the chance to go deep within a gender identity. We just want to make sure that we're doing it in a way that opens wide the experience for anyone who might wish to be a part of the community. What brings you the greatest joy? What brings you the greatest challenge? My answer to both is parenting. Recent events have really forced me to struggle with my beliefs about free speech. What do you believe about the right to free speech, particularly regarding repugnant, hateful, or threatening speech? What does the wider UU community have to say? I can say personally that I think there's a distinction that a lot of other countries actually make legally that we don't make here culturally or legally, that there's a difference between free speech and hate speech. And I think that that's something that we need to be really attentive to. I'm not sure what the wider UU community has to say about this. I suspect that we're growing in our capacity to consider that distinction that I just made and that question. We have a new president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, and she's an incredibly thoughtful and relational thinker about how it is that we can champion the freedoms that are ours by divine right, but also figure out how to get along in a way that don't trample other people's. I know she's in Charlotte. She has been in Charlottesville, and she is now. And I'm really looking forward to some public leadership from her about maybe this specifically, but other related issues. What are your thoughts on expanding the OWLS curriculum to our youngest students? So OWLS is our whole lives sexuality education curriculum is it's a set of classes. The first one is in kindergarten, and then it goes all the way up to a unit for elders to think about their own bodies and sexuality in that phase of life. And I actually think that each of the OWLS levels are really, really amazing and useful. And when I spoke a little bit more generally earlier about, like, we have to think about what our priorities are and what resources we have to apply to them, you know, with a different staffing structure, you know, an expanded RE staff structure, you know, I've served a congregation that ran 6 OWLS classes at once every year. And it was a hub for people in, you know, from many zip codes over. I think that would be great. Am I setting that as the one priority for us in the next decade? No, but I'm throwing it out there. If we're doing a brainstorming exercise, I think that's something that could be really cool. So we have a lot of questions, and I'm going to just end with a quick one so that we have time to hear from just a couple folks before we wrap up the service. And this last one is, it's not a question, it's a fill in the blank. The most important human trait is, and I would fill in that blank by saying kindness.